today. So I would like to show some studies on air power production that are possible to be done with the CMS detector using the first data collected with the first LHC physics run, hopefully at the end of 09 and early 010. So the first question we need to address, you know, when we give talks about physics you can do at LHC and you don't talk about new physics, is clearly why you want to study these things. Because obviously LHC is a discovery machine. We all of us know what are the target of this experiment. So why we should be interested in looking at physics that is clearly standard model, especially when we have a detector at LHC, LHCb, that is targeting to look at every quark. And the answer is pretty simple, that big quarks are a key ingredient for basically everything that LHC wants to do, either as direct signal, clearly b-tagging for top reconstruction, or going toward the Higgs, reconstruction of the Higgs at low mass, or a fundamental background due to the very large cross-section of forming physics searches, for example, SUSY. And you can see here an example of a typical signature of SUSY particles that involves big quarks in the final state, and then a detailed knowledge of the background from the bar events is crucial to disentangle new physics from standard QCD. Moreover, the fact that B-bar production has a very large cross-section, it allows to look at these events immediately as we start taking data. So we can start doing physics on every quark with the first weak data, already with a few picobar. And this is crucial not only to start to see QCD prediction at the LHC's energy, it is something that we have never seen before, because we are going to jump from 2 TV at the tevatron to 10 TV in the first LHC run, but we will have a large data sample that are going to be very clean to perform detailed studies on the detector. And so we'll discuss a bit what we can do about alignment, about what we can do with the trigger. And these are all studies we can do immediately with the first data using the channels, final state, that involve every quark. So how do we produce big quarks at LHC? So the dominant production mechanism, a leading order, is a gluon-gluon into big bar. And this is the most important production at LHC. SQQ bar annihilation can be the same, but very clearly at a very lower cross-section, much lower cross-section. And this typical signature involves the production of big quarks in the final state with kind of symmetric transverse momentum, usually in the central region. And this is also the characteristic region that was very easy to study at the tevatron in the central detector region. But then we have, and the cross-section are much higher, next to leading order production mechanism. In particular, the two most important ones are flower excitation and gluon splitting. The flower excitation is characterized by the fact that only one of the big quarks participates in the hard scattering, and therefore it can produce two big quarks with asymmetric PT, one with higher PT that has been involved in the hard scattering, and the other one at lower PT. And so because these two big quarks have asymmetric transverse momentum, what can happen is that one goes in the forward rapidity region and so cannot be detected, and so we only end up with one of the two big quarks. And so this is one of the projects that is very interesting to study HC because it's not very easy to detect. And then we have another one, the gluon splitting, where both big quarks are produced in the final state and are characterized by very low PT, and usually they are very close in the zimuthal direction. And this process is probably the most interesting one because the proximity of the two big quarks in the final state, it makes it very complicated to detect them. And therefore, they're not very well understood from the studies at the tevatron. And as we will see in the follow, they can be an important background in the b-tagging at the LHC. So understanding a bit more the details of this production mechanism is something that we need to do with the data. So what we can do at the LHC is clearly measuring the b-production, either by looking at the differential cross-section function of different variables, PT or the observed rapidity, or we can look at the correlation between BB bar, and as we see in the follow, this is very interesting because it's very sensitive to the ratio between the next leading order and the leading order production mechanism. So it's an important test of the QCD at the LHC energies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In the excitation process, is there a big cross-section for gluon production?
Yeah. So this cross-section at 14 TV.
The middle one
is 190 microbar. So these are the cross-section at 14 TV. So in total, the BB-bar cross-section is about 500 microbar. At 10 TV, they're almost the same. And the next leading order are clearly the most dominant one. You then have also next to next leading order production that are not very well studied, and something that we are neglecting here that is also present is a multi-heavy quark production. So you can easily end up with QQ bar heavy quarks with additional heavy quark in the final state. This is also something else that is not very well covered theoretically in these days. So, what has the Tevatron done so far in studying the big quarks? Obviously, they have done a lot. They actually started to look at big quarks already with the first data in the late 80s, and then still now they're producing a lot of results on big quark production. And the Tevatron has basically explored all the possible different ways in which you can detect these particles. So, single B production, either through exclusive Fourier reconstruction of B decays, for example, B2J psi K or B2J psi K star, inclusive reconstruction, where, for example, you only look at J psi in the final state, and then you use the lifetime to disentangle prompt decays of the J psi with respect to non prompt decays that are coming from the Bs. Semi-optonic decays, where you look at the impact parameter of a muon, and from the impact parameter you detect if this muon is coming from a displaced vertex or not. And then any kind of possible studies involving jets, so either combination of muon targeted in association with jets, and we will cover one analysis that can do the same approach in CMS, or just tagging directly jets using B-tagging. Regarding VV bar correlated production, the Tevatron has looked at the dimuons, so basically looking at the impact parameter for two leptons in the final state. Jpsi plus lepton, so using the one B decay into Jpsi and the other B decays into semitonic final state into lepton, and learning about the correlation of the B quark by looking at the correlation of the leptons that you are reconstructing in the final state. And then any possible combination with jets, either one mu to detect one B and the B-tagged jet for the second B, or two Bs. So, Tevatron has performed a lot of measurements. You can see here just a summary of all the publications. There are many more that I'm not including here. And one exercise that we can do is to compare the experimental results of the Tevatron with theoretical predictions. So, either with the standard nested encoder QCD, with the Mangano-Nasone-Ridolfi prediction, or a most recent results, that is this FONLL, that is a leading logarithmic approach at fixed order, that basically is an attempt to combine the leading order approximation that you have in standard QCD generators at the hadronic machines, as PETIA or Erwig, together with the next leading order correct theoretical calculation. And what you can do is just do a simple exercise and see how well the QCD is able to reproduce experimental results. So this exercise has been done. There is here a citation from this paper from PRD from 2 years ago, in which all the different results on inclusive B production from the Tevatron, both from CDF and D0, have been evaluated using a common theory benchmark. So all these results have been combined, try to combine them using the same input from the QCD regarding the external parameters that are included. And then we can compare these results with the theory. And so looking at this plot that shows the ratio between the data results for the cross-section and the theory prediction, one represents the standard QCD prediction with an uncertainty that we have fixed as about 15% for a theoretical prediction that probably is a bit smaller, but it's what has been done in this paper. And as you can see, we have the first surprise. Now, we look at all the different measurements for the Tevatron, and there is consistently a strong disagreement between the data and the QCD. So consistently, the data are larger than 1, usually between 1.5 and 3, the exclusive decays analysis are the one that, despite they should be the simplest one because they're exclusively reconstructing the final state, are the one with the largest shift. And as you can see, more or less all the other measurements are far off from the theoretical prediction.
I didn't understand R equals, what is that point, R equals 1?
This one is the perfect theory prediction. So it's basically this ratio R between data and theory.
Is where one is, okay.
Yeah. So this 1 plus minus 15% is what we can call the theory prediction.
Okay, gotcha.
So you just want to look at the distance between the green band and all the different measurements from the Tevatron. So we can make a few comments about this interesting result. So first of all, the agreement slightly improves at large PT, and this is maybe a sign that we're not understanding completely the dynamics at low PT. And then a second, all these measurements involving leptons are the ones that are really far off. And so we have to keep in mind when we are going to look at the B-bar correlation that a bunch of results, including leptons in the final state, are showing this discrepancy between theory and data. So, yeah.
So since this is quite a range of years of mm-hmm. results, how much has the theory changed since 1993 to 2007?
So this is discussed a bit in this paper, and basically looking at the latest theoretical approach that I described, the next to leading the FONLLL approach, the theory prediction can be changed by up to 50%. So you can basically move this point up to 50%. And you can clearly try to associate to be a bit more conservative in the estimate of the system of the theory error. And so you can move this up by 50%, and the discrepancy between the average of these measurements and the new theoretical value can be estimated as something around 30-40%. So we are not, if you look at the last theoretical approach, we're not anymore a factor 2 off, that is what you get naively by combining, by making the average of these measurements, but it's something around 30-40%. As I will show, the latest experimental results from the Tevatron using JETS, and we're going to discuss why, and using more refined techniques are in very good agreement with the theoretical estimates. So, I'm going to discuss a bit about it. Yeah, I'm going to talk a bit about it. I'm not going to say anything about. I'm not going to interpret it, but I'm going to say something about it. Okay, so we discussed that we can do inclusive single B production. Then we can look at B bar correlations, and again we can compare the. We can look at this ratio, not the data against the estimate of the prediction. No, one would be perfect agreement between data and theory. And here we see again something very interesting. So first of all, we have a similar pattern. A few measurements are in quite strong disagreement with the expected theory. But if we look at the measurements involving only BJETs, the agreement actually is not so bad. So these measurements are in quite good agreement. The production mechanism involved in studying an inclusive production with transferable bar correlation are slightly different. In B-bar correlation, as I was discussing, we are really sensitive only to the central region. The Tevatron cannot assess the full kinematic that the B-quark can produce. But still, it's interesting to compare what we get with JETS and with respect to what we get with purely leptonic signature. And so this interesting disagreement between analysis without muons and analysis with muons has triggered some more studies from CDF. And this is the famous ghost muon puzzle that has been quite famous in the last few months. And I'm going to discuss briefly what happened. So basically, what CDF has discovered is that looking at the impact parameter of the muons that are reconstructed, they observed a large extent, a large fraction of muons produced with a very large impact parameter, up to 2 centimeters, while the one from prompt muon decay or from semi-leptonic or cascade sham decays can only usually arrive to the usually 0.2 centimeters. So we are talking about a difference of factor 10 between the known region for production of muons with respect to what they are observing. And now CDF has been triggered by this in looking carefully about possible underestimated background sources for this muon, and they were able to account for about 50% of them. But still, they end up with a ratio of about 1-to-1 between this background of muons with a very long live, with a very long lifetime, and real muons. And clearly, this background contribution is something that was affecting the CDF results on B-bar correlation and also on inclusive B-production. And actually, by applying Tiger cuts in the silicon tracker to remove these events of very large parameter, they end up with a much closer agreement in studies of B-production between the theory and the experimental data. So clearly, a few people have been triggered by this not to make interpretation about new physics regarding this muon, but what we can say is that there has been a large unaccounted background of long kind of leave the real muons or phase, depending on what they really are. That is one of the reasons for the interesting disagreement between data and theory that has been observed by the CDF measurements. And actually, if we look at one of the latest results from CDF, shown at IHEP in 08, in a study of U-bar correlation, so looking at the zimuthal correlation between the two big quarks, you can see that the agreement between the data and the next reading golden Monte Carlo prediction in blue is quite good. And again, this is a study involving only bijets, and so completely unaffected by this problem involving muons. So clearly, what this kind of study prompts is that LHC will be sensitive to studying the tails of muons, and we can see if SLHC and CMS will observe this interesting pattern regarding muons with a long lifetime.
Is it understood why Hurwitz and Pythia don't quite do the job?
Yeah, it's basically how Pythia, using the leading logarithmic approximation, accounts for the nested leading order production. So Pythia is clearly not a real nested leading order Monte Carlo. They have some approximations, and if you look in detail about the cross-section, there are differences up to a factor 4 between the nested leading order contribution between Pythia and nested leading order Monte Carlo, and the nested leading order part is the one that dominates, as I was discussing, at low delta phi equals. So this is clearly a region where we are sensitive to this. Okay, so we have more puzzles. So as if we look at inclusive quarkonia production, so Gpsi or Upsilon, things are not really clear. So the direct Gpsi production is not fully understood. We don't have, still now, a model that can simultaneously account for the cross-section and for the polarization of the Gpsi. So we have different models on the market, color singlet model available in many different less leading order and higher order models. It basically is a very good approximation in which you neglect the color, the possible not for the glue in the final state, not to turn multiple colors. And you can see here that the data, also when compared to next leading order Monte Carlo, are still in disagreement. So there are pretty things that are not completely clear. And then you have more complicated models that are quite better in accounting for the cross-section, so in particular non-relativistic QCD approaches, including the color octet mechanism, but that fail very badly in accounting for the measured polarization at the tail. So you can see here the disagreement between the NRQCD prediction for the polarization with respect to data from the tevatron, both for the Gpsi and the Psi2S, is quite strong. And similarly for the Upsilon inclusive production, we have the same kind of issues both in the differential cross-section and in the polarization. So there are clearly many things that are not clear, and because the LHC will benefit for such a large B-bar cross-section, this is something that we can test immediately with the first weak data.
Can I ask you, I'm not sure about this. In the data, you don't distinguish between direct production of Gpsi versus Gpsi from B quark.
Clearly you can.
You can.
Clearly you can. No, if you look at the lifetime, you clearly can do that.
Okay.
These are just inclusive production looking in the central rapidity region, and they can clearly be sensitive to the relative ratio between prompt and non-prompt production, but it's not clearly.
So all the contribution has been removed.
In this one, I think that actually is inclusive, including prompt and non-prompt production.
Okay.
Yeah.
And theory is all inclusive.
Yeah. Okay. So clearly, LHC and CMS in particular has a very aggressive plan to take on in detail B-bar production, B studies using the first data. This is just an example of what CMS can do in order of increasing luminosity and complexity, moving from first week data, where clearly you cannot imagine that you will know in extremely detail the detector, up to large integrated luminosity, where you can take colorar decays that are more sensitive to new physics effect, but for which clearly, because the bench inflation are very small, you will need a lot of data. So as you can see, CMS can basically take all of these paths that I've described so far. So we can look at cross-section for B charm, inclusive Gpsi, exclusive B decays, Gpsi K, Gpsi K star. We can study in detail the puzzles on the quarkonia, looking at the production cross-section, looking at the polarization, and then study the V-bar correlations. As you can see, we can start from a pure electronic signature, so forgetting about the jets, and so not thinking if we will understand enough well the jet reconstruction in the detector, moving to final states involving the jets. And then studying in detail lifetime and properties of all the behedrons. That is something that right now the CDF and the Zero are doing extremely well. And then moving to most esoteric and interesting stuff, Abyss-Abyss oscillations, CP violation, flavor change neutral currents and rare decays, very rare decays as pure leptonic channels, up to lepton flavor violation violation processes as tau into 3 mu. So we're going to concentrate on what we can do with the first 100 picobarn of data. That is what, hopefully, we will get by the end of the first time in 0.10.
I have a question about the previous step. I mean, in some sense, how much do we really know about the hadronization of a B quark in a color field, which is CDF?
Mm-hmm.
It's the only measurement, CDF and D0, because... So if you have a B quark from QCD, you assume that it becomes a B0 or a B+.
Or a B sub S or a baryon.
Yeah, but...
I mean, what we have...
What is... But that's...
I mean, what we have is the measurements from LEP on the B quark hadronization into the different meson or baryons that is measured at up to a few percent. So we know that small b going to BU or BD is about 40% with less than 5% error. And then what the B meson and the baryons do, but in particular the B meson, is what we learned at the B factors. So the knowledge
but
that we have...
Learn, that's what I'm saying. You don't learn all the full spectroscopy of the B, to what excitants, B mesons, etc. And if they are hadronizing to B stars...
Yeah, I mean, we have measurements...
stars are decaying...
Yeah, I mean, we have measurements from LEP. We clearly have some measurements with large errors for all the different spectra of
okay,
B star excitations.
Okay, but also, as I mentioned, in the presence of a color field like in, that could make difference, like a CDF, whereas an E plus E minus... I mean, I'm just asking, people are worried about this, or it's not at all an issue?
I mean, we rely to what has been measured with uncertainties up to 10%. So we trust these measurements, and we do not assume that they should be too much dependent on the environment, hopefully. I mean, we trust...
No, you shouldn't, but data is twice higher, so...
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Clearly, I mean, we require...
There are some changes. Strings and what have you that are put in, which are different than the hadronic environment than the E plus or minus environment. So
yeah,
try to take care of that, but whether it's done really correctly, you know, it's a question.
I'm just wondering if that sort of thing could explain it, in which case it's not a problem.
Mm-hmm.
There's no
way. In the theoretical papers I read and all the paper to interpret and all these puzzles, they really have focused on. QCD effects with respect to the B fragmentation. And actually, you know, there are a few analyses that are not very sensitive. I probably not just wrote just a note that are not very sensitive to the nature of the B fragmentation, especially involving jets in the final state. And you see the puzzle also in these analyses that are not very sensitive. So there is a D0 analysis only looking at jets it's not sensitive to fragmentation, and they show the same puzzle. So it's really coming, I mean, the idea is that it's really coming from the QCD. Okay, so very fast we discovered what CMS is. So it's a quite large detector, but not as large as ATLAS, and it's a strength really coming from the very strong magnetic field. No, it's a 4 pi acceptance detector, and the real core of the detector is a huge silicon pixel tracker. It's the largest field so far, with more than 1,400 active modules. And then you can see the different components here. And the muon chambers is what I'm going to describe in detail in this talk, because this is what we can trigger on for studies on B-quark production. And so I'm going to spend some time describing how the muon reconstruction is done in CMS. So the muon system for CMS is characterized by 3 main different detectors covering either the barrel or the end cap region. So you have drift tube chambers covering the barrel region, resistive plate chambers covering both the barrel and the cap region and characterized by a very fast response that allow to use the RPC output at trigger, already at level 1, and then the catalyst tube chambers in the cap region. So as I was mentioning, to perform these studies, we will need to trigger on the muon, so we can study a bit more in detail how the muon reconstruction is done in CMS. This is a slice of the detector in the transverse direction. So starting from the interaction point, the track, the cal, the h-cal, the superconducting solenoid, and then the different moon chambers that are interspersed between the yoke of the return yoke of the return yoke of the magnetic field. So, in order to use as much as possible the information provided by the detector, for the muon reconstruction, the experiment has worked a kind of twofold strategy. One that we can call the standard one, that is a kind of outside-in approach, and then a second one that is said is an in-outside approach. So the standard reconstruction technique for muons in CMS will be to start looking at the muon chambers, and so building two-dimensional projections and then extrapolating to full three-dimensional projections in the muon chambers for the muons, and use, thanks to the fast response of the RPC, the information given by this muon reconstruction already at level 1 in the trigger. And then, basically, extrapolating back using a Kármán filter the three-dimensional projection, the three-dimensional segments of muons reconstructed in the muon chambers back to the tracker region, detecting a region of interest in the tracker, that is the basically the extrapolation direction of the muon segment from the muon chambers up to the detector, and then combining tracks that are in this region of interest in the muon direction with the muon segments, and performing again a global fit combining the tracker information and the muon chamber information to finalize the creation of the muon object and using this information in the high-level trigger for the muon. So this is the standard approach, but as you can imagine, because it requires the full reconstruction of the muon segments in the muon chambers, it requires IGPT object. So it's clearly something that is perfect to do Z or W reconstruction, but it's something that is not optimal for low-PT reconstruction, so in particular for B decay. So the CMS has elaborated a new strategy that is an in-outside strategy. And in this case, what CMS does is that it assumes that each reconstructed charged track in the tracker is a muon candidate. And then it extrapolates forward each track, and it looks at the compatibility of this track to be a muon object, both looking at the deposit of energy in the calorimeters and looking at the segments in the muons that are compatible with the direction of the track extrapolated from the tracker. And if not this combination of tracker and the segments matches some quality cuts, call this object a muon. So basically what this technique does is that it allows to have a track, reconstructing the track that extrapolates forward into the muon detector, but maybe in just one segment, maybe in just one station of the muon chambers, and so this allows to give a much higher efficiency for the reconstruction of low-PT muons.
That's the trigger you learned with this, right? This is offline.
So the trigger only relies on full reconstructed muons coming from the global fit combining the tracker.
So how do you trigger on these?
What happens is that very often... So let's say that you not look at these muons, but you look at the low-PT ones. What happens is that very often, at least one of the two muons has its in the two muon chambers, and so despite it's reconstructed with a different approach, corresponds to the same muon that you are reconstructing from the standard approach. So you're reconstructing it twice. You're basically multiplying...
Okay.
So you basically have different muon categories... overlapping. And so what happens is that now you're reconstructing in a different way, but you're triggering on the same object.
Okay.
So this is clearly something that recently has been started to study. No? Up to 1 year ago, I would say people were only looking at the standard outside-in approach with the standard global muon object, but we realized that for low-PT object, it's not the winning strategy.
But if you knew that if you only take tracks that are impact parameters, then you could do it at trigger level.
I mean, we already cut the trigger level on the impact parameter, but it's a very loose cut. It's extremely loose. It's 2 centimeters. So it's already included in the HT. But I mean, it's a very, very loose cut. Because you want, in particular, after these new results about... Now you really want to keep the full spectrum. Okay, see, here I just described what I just told you. And this feature here now is a nice example of what I mean by being more efficient for low PT mu. So you can see on the, to the curvature in the magnetic field, you can easily end up with object with 4 or 4.5 GeV that are only giving hits in one chamber in the muon system. And so using this alternative inside-out approach, you are able to recover efficiency for this object. So this is something that CMS is really looking forward to do. So here you can see a standard plot looking at the resolution as a function of PT. And as you can see, the full combination of the information from the tracker and the muon chambers is what a low PT gives a very high, very nice resolution. So you can see at low PT, the inner track is what dominates to give the best resolution. And then clearly moving at a very large PT, you know, special resolution alignment become crucial. But as you can see from this plot, we can get up to 10% in resolution to 1 TV. And CMS can also look in detail at muon with extremely high energy up to the 1 TV region. Okay, so for these studies, what we want to do is clearly trigger on muons. So as probably all of you know, now we start from the level 1 trigger, from 40 MHz to 200 kHz. At level 1, we have already information coming from the muon system. And then we move to the HT, L2 and L3, to go to the 100 Hz, that is the rate acceptable for writing to tape.
The 200 kHz is at?
Is the intermediate, what we can call L2 level. But, I mean, these days we are not really looking anymore at L2 objects. No? We just move from L1 to HT. So this is an intermediate process. In the muon reconstruction, we actually still have what we call the L2 muon, but you know, what we trigger on is the HT L3 muon. Okay, so CMS has been working on different trigger strategies, no? Because in particular with the delay after the accident last September, we are going to start at 10 TV, probably at low luminosity, 8 to the 29, and then hopefully moving to 1 to the 31 on a reasonable time scale. And clearly what the experiment is looking to do is using different trigger menus that, especially at low luminosity, will allow to maximize the amount of low PT object that you can record on disk that is clearly crucial for big work studies. So,
that is good for you.
Yeah, for us it's
good.
See,
X-ray was good for me physics.
You easily have difference up to a factor 2 in the acceptance coming from the trigger if you move from a single to a double mu trigger. And I would actually say that we are not completely happy with the current trigger menu, but we will see what we can get. Because in particular, the single mu trigger that is going to be unprescaled, this one at 9 GV. I mean, if we can keep it, if we can have a lower threshold unprescaled, they will clearly benefit the B analysis. So we see what we can get. It really depends on how much off we are in our rates estimate. Okay, so what we can look at is the muon triggers. So, for example, 2 muons with at least 3 GV, that is usually the minimum amount of PT that we need to trigger on. In the HT, for which we have a normal muon trigger, that basically the L1 extrapolation to L3 for the 2 muon subject, or we have already a very fast vertex reconstruction that can be used to trigger on displaced vertices at the HLT level. And then a single muon trigger, so the one that probably will be unprescaled in the full trigger menu is with a cut on PT and NGV, that clearly, you know, is already cutting away a lot of the phase space that the big quark can... The big work live on, and other thresholds are available with different prescalings, and we will see which ones will be.
Why don't you put an impact parameter right here? Just at the single muon with impact parameter. You don't have that.
No, the cut on the impact parameter is coming here, it's present in the ear.
But if you put it there, you could lower the PT.
Yeah, actually, what people are looking at, and hopefully they will be successful. Is lower this threshold and combining with a track back-to-back, so opposite in phi, because basically what happens is that the lower you go down in PT here, the lower you go in the spectrum for the GPSI, so you can try to basically detect the GPSI where the muons are emitted back-to-back. So what you can try to do is trigger one muon and then ask just for a track in the opposite direction in phi. And these can give a large reduction in the trigger rate, so that still will be accessible, losing clearly some efficiency, obviously, because now that they're all back-to-back. But clearly, no, this is understudied, because the lower we can have this threshold, the better it is. And actually, the ideal for first studies is to have a single muon HT at 3GV. That is the perfect scenario to do high statistics study with the first data.
So for 9GV, you need a
See, yeah, so 9GV should be unprescaled. Then we have 5GV.
I'm sorry?
Not
prescaled. Yeah. The previous threshold at 5GV has a prescaling factor of 25.
So
9GV is unprescaled.
Pre-scaled.
Yeah.
You think that you could avoid any prescaling even down lower if you had this other
Hopefully, yeah. Because clearly, you know, this cut is very strong. No? We are really sensitive to the region LOPT. And whatever we can get lower than this is perfect. I mean, already if the first three picobarn are taken with a single mu trigger at 3GV, it will be perfect. We can already do a lot of things.
I mean, I have a completely different interest in this, you know, to track the pigs production.
So, yeah, you really don't care about
the
this.
The lower we can get that threshold, but we're quite happy with a few tracks plus
Absolutely.
That would be great.
Okay, so let's start to look in detail at what CMS can do. So, one of the first studies is to look at the differential cross section for inclusive genotype production. And what we can do is to measure, first of all, the inclusive rate coming from either prompt or non-prompt production, and then looking at the B-quark component, so how many gypsy are coming from B-quark production. So as you can see, already with 3 picobarn, we have tens of thousands of events with reasonable signal-to-noise. Here you can see the trigger efficiency level 1 and HT. You can see here the explanation for which we are really sensitive to the low PT region, so why it would be really crucial to go down as much as possible with the threshold for the PT. So all these plots are coming with the double mu trigger with 3GV cut, and clearly you see that we are not sensitive for transfer momentum of the gypsy smaller than 5GV. And so clearly, now what we can gain in this region, it's all going to benefit this kind of analysis. So this is something that we can already do with 3 picobarn.
Back to that previous thing. What makes the QCD background so large there?
This is logarithmic scale, no? This is logarithmic scale. This QCD background is mainly Dralian. So it's muon, it's random combinatoric from two muons coming from Dralian production. This is what mainly goes into this black.
What do you mean by common? Just looking at two muons.
Yeah, and just doing the invariant mass. So it's pure combinatoric combining two muon in the event. And look, this is logarithmic scale, no? So this is a factor 100 difference.
So that's not really end. Then you're talking this decay in flight or something.
This is not included here, I think, not in these studies. What goes into this QCD background is Dralian, and clearly you also have the case in flight. I don't think this analysis is from 0.7. I don't know if they already looked at the case in flight at the time. But clearly, you know, you have a large rate for pion and K on the case in flight. At the very low PT, they clearly kick in. So
when you say that's pre-scaled, what do you mean? I'm confused by that statement. You said that background was pre-scaled?
No.
Log scale.
It's logarithmic scale.
Oh, log scale.
So it's a factor 100. It's a factor 100 between the peak and the red component.
Right. Yeah. I have again a different interest in this. Mm-hmm. I'd like to be able to look for a light pseudoscalar guy in this sort of mass range.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, up near the upsilon. So there's an upsilon peak, of course, that occurs a little bit
clearly,
later. And it seems like the backgrounds are present at Tevatron are smaller compared to the general peaks, the J-psi and the epsilon, than they are in CMS. And that's just because I guess you have a much higher high zero production rate or whatever.
Yeah, because in flight clearly are much more abundant. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so So something else we can do is to look at the polarization. As you can see, the reconstruction efficiency is clearly strongly dependent on the polarization, going to unpolarize to transverse longitudinal. This is something that CMS doesn't plan to do with the first and picobound of data, but it's already something that we can be done within the first run. And clearly, it's very important now to understand how the efficiency affects, looking at how the efficiency affects the reconstruction, estimating properly the systematic uncertainty coming from the polarization, that, as I described previously, is completely unknown and not understood looking at the Tevatron results. So after we have done the inclusive differential cross-section, we can look at the prompt versus non-prompt component. And this is done by looking at the lifetime, so in particular here looking at the pseudo flight distance of this object. As you can see, this nicely allows to discriminate between prompt production, that is a pure resolution function with zero lifetime, and the big quark contribution that is coming from a displaced vertex. And so looking at the distance between the gypsy vertices and the primary vertex, you can easily allow to discriminate between prompt and non-prompt production. So here you have an example of this fit in one particular region of PT for the gypsy. And this is clearly a site that can be done already with the first picobound of data collected. So the differential cross-section and the big quark fraction is a target of the experiment. These studies were performed with 14 TV in the standard rapidity region covered by CMS. And you can see that already with 3 picobarn, you are basically dominated by the systematics, and you are competitive with the Tevatron result. So this is something that can be done immediately, and will immediately allow a nice comparison with the Tevatron results and with the QCD predictions. Okay, so the next step will be to look at inclusive reproduction, and we present you two possibilities to look into it. One is looking at JETS, so it looks at bitagging. So what is the bitagging in hadronic machines? It's simply looking at the JETS and then combining information from the construction of the jets into algorithms and give a number that is the probability that you are detecting a bit jet. So CMS has a broad range of algorithms suitable for bitagging, and clearly a few of them are very complicated involving multivariate techniques and they were not to be suitable for the early data, but a few of them that require pure track properties is something that can already be done with the first data. So for example, one algorithm looks at the impact parameter significance of all the tracks that are reconstructed in the jet. So for each track in the jet, we compute the impact parameter significance, and then we sort them in order of increasing significance, and then we look at the second or the third track, because the first is assumed to be biased just as an effect of the reconstruction, and we cut on this quantity to detect, as a discriminator to detect the bijets. And this is something that is shown nicely in this plot. So bijets are in the forward direction, upward of the primary vertex with a positive sign, and are predominating in this region. And this is something that we can do immediately in the beginning. It can already be applied at the trigger level. And the nice feature about this algorithm is that applying a negative tag, so basically cutting in the region below zero, you can easily study on data the mistake probability. So all the estimates about mistag is something that you want to do with a data-driven approach, and this kind of algorithm allows you to do it directly on data.
Coming back to that graph, what is that red line on the negative side? I guess I'm not too clear on that.
This one...
There's a red line, for example, on that side. What is that red line?
These probably are misreconstructed jets. So the B-jets is the red line field, and these are probably misreconstructed objects that are going to very large negative value. So it's B-jets... at truth level, but completely misreconstructed, they give you the wrong sign. Okay, so something else that can be done looking at bitagging is see how it is affected by misalignment of the detector. We are clearly going to start with what we imagine is a misaligned detector, but in the end, well, because we already collected a lot of cosmic rays, we have already kind of primordial alignment of our detector. So you can see as moving from a startup condition to a full alignment, the performance of this tagging algorithm will completely change. So for example, for these light flavored jets that are the ones that you want to remove, with a startup they will be faking much more often B-jets, and it's the opposite, the B-jets will fake more, will be more similar to light flavored jets. So clearly study using an OB tagging jet at the beginning will require a very important understanding of the misalignment. And what you can do with the first data to improve the alignment of your detector is again look at the gypsy and upsilon. So not only you can do physics measurements looking at gypsy and upsilon, but you can also use reconstruction of these decays to help the alignment of your detector, because clearly you have dimuons, and so you can easily see how the vertexing is performing.
I think Kraft has beaten that number already, 20 microns.
It's already better than that?
I think it's 15.
This number is from...
As of CMS week, I believe it's 15.
This number is June 08, so probably
no,
it's better.
Yeah, it's already 15.
It's already better, yeah. Okay, other algorithms that you can use with 3D data is just looking for a secondary vertex. That is a clear signature of a displaced vertex. And as you can see here, looking at the efficiency of the reconstructed B-jet compared with the mistag probability, you see that why for charm and the light quark jet, you know, this curve just goes down quite flat. For gluon jet, this curve basically gets flat because you have this kind of irreducible background from real B quarks coming from gluon spitting of G going to B bar. And these are the ones that, with a better understanding of the B production mechanism, will probably be understood better. Because obviously, if we are including the rate of gluon spitting in our Monte Carlo with a very, very large wrong rate, obviously this fake probability will be completely different. So, knowing better the rate, so the production cross section for gluon spitting, is something that can help in better understanding the mistag probability in this kind of studies. And then clearly you can also look at jets, and clearly for the jets you only cover 20% of the final state, and but no, this is clearly a nice algorithm that you can already use with the first data. Okay, so one analysis that has been done 3 years ago on simulation that can be done with early data is inclusive production looking at single mu within a jet, and I would just want to give you the details about how it's done. So what you do is identify a muon within a jet, and then what you compute is the relative momentum is the relative transverse momentum of the muon with respect to the jet direction, is what you call a PTRL, and this allows very nicely to distinguish between bottom production, charm, or light quarks. And as you can see, for B quark, this distribution of PTRL is peaked at Dagger values with respect to light quarks. So, by looking at the distribution, you can distinguish between the production of B quark with respect to charm or light quarks. And already with a few picobarn, this is the kind of analysis that you can perform and measure the inclusive B cross section on a very large range in PT. And as you can see, already with a few picobarn, we start to be systematically limited. So it's not really a problem of statistics. With one investment, we have already more than 1 million signal events, real B-target jets. But it's really a problem of how well we understand the systematics, in particular here, the jet energy scale, to perform precision measurements on the inclusive production. Okay, another side can be performed with very, very fast data, so up to 50 picobarn, is the study of B bar correlations using a pure leptonic signature, so just reconstructing leptons in the final state. So what you do is that one B is targeted by its gypsy decay into mu, and the other B by another mu in the event. And the distribution you're interested in is the azimuthal correlation, so delta phi angle, that is very sensitive to the different production mechanisms, so peaked at high values, production back-to-back for leading order production, and then spread over all the range for next leading order, and in particular for the gluon spitting, focused at very low values on delta phi. So basically the two B quarks are produced in a very narrow cone. And this is the region that is not accessible when you look at jets, because obviously you are not able to distinguish clearly two B quark jets in the same cone. But it's something that you can look with this kind of approach. This is the resolution that you get comparing the BV quark delta phi with respect to the reconstructed one, and is a nice proof that you can actually achieve this measurement looking at a full leptonic signature. So what you do here is reconstruct the job psi with all the different background components, and then look at the delta phi distribution, adding an additional muon. You can see the background, as expected, is mainly focused at low delta phi angle, because clearly is where you are most sensitive to misreconstruction. And because the job psi is selected looking at the best vertex combination, pure combinatoric from muons is going preferentially to go into the low delta phi region, so to go in the region where the two muons are very close to each other. So what you can do is measure the distribution on data by fitting different variables. So what we propose is a simultaneous three-dimensional ambient maximum likelihood fit, looking at the job psi invariant mass, the transverse flight length, as done in the inclusive job psi analysis, that basically allows to discriminate between prompt and non-prompt decays, and the impact parameter of the third muon. This is a typical fit that you can already try to get with 13 picobar. So with very small luminosity, with about 1 month luminosity, you can have about 2,000 events, and this fit clearly allows to discriminate between real signal components in red and all the different background components in the other colors. So the goal is to extract delta phi distribution. So the analysis is quite involved, because once you have the reconstructed distribution, or by fitting all the different variables in several different intervals in the zimuthal correlation, you clearly don't have the real generated distribution, because you have acceptance effects coming from the trigger and the selection that are shaping and sculpting this distribution. So what you want to do is do an unfolding procedure, so basically moving from the reconstructed back to the generator level, and what you can get is a very nice agreement between the reconstructed distribution, the point with arrow bars, and the generated ones in red.
This assumes you know the three cross sections.
No, this only assumes that you know the acceptance. This is not sensitive.
No, these are the three crosses. You have to know their contribution.
Yeah. So this unfolding technique allows you to measure the bias that you have with respect to the production mechanism. So what you can do is evaluating the systematic, how much you are affected if you are completely wrong into the production mechanism. So clearly now you are sensitive, because the efficiency strongly depends on what is leading order, what is next to leading order. But we chose this unfolding because...
But your R value, the deviation from data to theory,
mm-hmm.
is there a way to tell how much it is for each SCDS? I mean, for the three mechanism, is it the same amount or different amount?
So this is something that is not being done with CDF data, but it is always believed to be coming from the next leading order production. So really coming from this region. So what we do in this analysis, in the systematic, is boosting this component by factor 5, by factor 10, and then see how the algorithm performs. So you get a systematic that keeps this into account. So all this analysis targeting the use of early data needs to have all the systematics to be data-driven and try to be as less sensitive as possible on the Monte Carlo, because otherwise... we know that we will not be able to trust the detector with a 5 picoband of data. So what we can do here is try to be conservative in the systematics that are coming from the Monte Carlo that we cannot measure on data. Try to be very conservative and using a proper mechanism. Okay, so what you can do is measure the cross-section. So you can see already with 50 picobar, you can measure the inclusive V-bar cross-section up to 10%. And measuring the contribution from the last reading order looking in the tail of this region. So these are all things that we can do with a small amount of data, clearly waiting for the data to arrive. So for the last 2 minutes that I'm already out of my time, I want to go a bit further. So this is clearly very speculative. So what we can really try to do now by studying in the tail of our production at HC, and one possibility that it's probably the most intriguing, but also the most difficult one, is to think about the Higgs. So if we believe that Evatron, we can probably do, the region that the easiest one to be assessed experimentally at HC, the one between 160 and 180, where we can reconstruct Higgs in WW and ZZ, is the one that the Evatron is excluding. So what we need to go is start to consider the low energy, and this is clearly something that CMS is already doing, either by looking at the gamma-gamma or looking at tau-tau. Clearly gamma-gamma is the channel, is the golden channel you want to look at small mass. We can, I mean, first studies from CMS already claim a 3 sigma with one Fico burn, so with one inverse Fico burn. So it's something that we can do on a reasonable time scale, but clearly no, it has a lot of question marks coming from how well we understand the backgrounds, which is the resolution of our photons, and so it's clearly something that we cannot give for guarantee. You can look at tau-tau. This is doable. It has been done already with preliminary studies, but it's clearly very challenging just for the nature of the tau decays. What about X and B bar? This is clearly the most intriguing and fascinating point. A few attempts have already been made in some very particular decay chain as TT bar associated production with the X, with TT bar going into W, so detecting 4 bijets in the final state and then using the 1 lepton to increase the signal to noise. This has been done in CMS, but it's encouraging, but it requires a lot of work. This is what we get with 30 inverse Fento bar, and it's less than 3 sigma. So it's something that we can probably try to do, but as you can see, it's very difficult, it's dominated by the background, and it requires a detailed knowledge of pure QCD background in final states involving B-quarks. So a detailed knowledge of the B-quark production is something that we need to better understand the pure QCD background in searches for the X for new physics. Another possibility, not considered so far, but interesting for several reasons, is associated production, so WH or ZH. This is characterized by very low cross-section, so it's clearly extremely challenging, you know, because clearly you can get it only with QQ or QQ bar. It's clearly very complicated, but it's something that it needs to be considered. And clearly, if you want to do this, the detailed knowledge of inclusive cross-section of WBB bar and ZBB bar from pure QCD needs to be measured and understood at that LHC energies. So this is something that we need to think about. Okay, so as I try to prove to you, B quarks are crucial ingredient for any kind of LHC analysis and real long-term goals. And the larger cross-section is something that allows to do simultaneously real physics, testing QCD, and service work understanding in a better way the detector, and we can be competitive with the tevatrons with the tevatron very fast. It's important to measure these properties because we need to understand, we need to disentangle pure QCD effects that are maybe not understood because we do not understand very well the cross-sections from real new physics signatures that we can see either in these decays or in whatever physics searches we are going to look for. And clearly, you know, we need the data, so hopefully the first physics run will start at the end of the year, and we will be able to start measuring something. Thanks.
I have a question working back to the multi-muon business. Mm-hmm. So you said that if you require isolated muons, then the agreement is much better because you're throwing away all those ghost events, possibly.
Yeah, actually, it was not really. It's a combination of isolation and tight request in the pixel. So, cutting on the impact parameter and requiring. I don't remember all the details about CDF analysis, but I think the most important cut was a certain number of hits in the pixel for these muons. Mm-hmm.
Now, the thing that I suddenly realized I'm confused about is that this would work for CDF because CDF sees a big difference between their ghost curve and their QCD curve. But T0, when they did this measurement, the ghost curve was high, but also their background was mm-hmm. equally high, so that a similar cut would not appear to help mm-hmm. reduce their B cross-section in the D0 case. Has D0 done this same analysis?
I think they did, This clearly didn't come out with any result, no? So I'm not a tevatron guy, so I don't know.
Their B bar cross section is in better agreement with theory mm-hmm. after doing these tighter cuts. In other words,
I think the zero started to look at it, but I don't have the taste. What I can show you is that We can do it in CMS. So if you look at our impact parameter here, you can see that we can look at the impact parameter and discriminate very nicely between displaced muons in red from prompt or punch through or decays in flight, you know, that are most peaked around zero. So for us, you know, the impact parameter works very nicely, and we can trust it to look at these very large impact parameter objects. And you know, the trigger cut we have in the impact parameter is 2 centimeters, so we should be sensitive to these stays. And clearly, I mean, if we see the same excess, we need to understand the background much better. So it's something important.
So I don't know about it, D0, but in CDF, not in the trigger, but for reconstruction of muons, we have minimum ionizing tracks that don't shower in the calorimeter, don't mm-hmm. necessarily get any muon hits. Mm-hmm. Is there even any need for that at CMS?
Already now, you can use a calorimeter information. You have a category of muon reconstructed that are called the calo muons, and they use calorimeter information. The reconstruction efficiency that we have tested in the LOPT region clearly goes up a lot, but the background is huge. So I think people want to use it, but... I mean, the statistics is not an issue, so...
Right, so you don't need it.
You don't need it. Already in this analysis, because we use this category of muons at LOPT, so this inside-out approach, what we use as a variable to clean up our sample is a two-dimensional likelihood using the calorimeter and the muon chamber information. So we already use partially the calorimeter information. They can be used much more, but I don't know. I mean, I don't know much you want to rely on them. So yeah, it can clearly be done. I mean, it's currently available, but I don't know. I would not think that it's crucial for this kind of studies.
Right. You need it for searches where you're trying to increase your acceptance.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And make up for.
Yeah. So I'm trying to think if, because I remember a Z analysis, and maybe they are looking at all the possible muon categories that you can use. It's a possibility that they were considering also the calo muons, the calorimeter muons. But I would say that at the beginning, more you probably want to use them more than to measure something to understand how well the simulation reconstructs them.
Have a comment. You know, you said this is service work, early B physics, but there are probably 50 to 100 graduate students who would be grateful to do this work and get out of
high school. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
So,
yeah.
Anyway, there's no more questions. That's good stuff. You can do physics with 3 Tycho bars.
Yeah.